Is everyone having a good time here this weekend in the Bayou Lane Denver? I would like to thank all you people for being here, for only me and my recovery, because without y'all here, I couldn't be here. And if no one told you they loved you today, I do. And for that, I'm surely grateful. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Ed. Ed met Ed here this last Thursday. My sponsor, Joe R., we went and picked him up at the airport. He's a small man. I've been telling him for the last 3 days to watch his head. He's a wonderful person. He's full of spirituality. I love what he has. And I hope one day that I'll be able to have what he has. And he had his first Cubillon. Miss Boogie made his first Cubillon. Give it to him at the camp. And his first etouffee. And I know he really loved that. So without any further ado, do you think we could give him a warm Cajun welcome? Ed, come on up.
My name is Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Bettendorf Big Book Study Group in Bettendorf, Iowa, and my sobriety date is January 5th of 1971. And I want to share with you that I love God, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being sober, and I don't apologize for any of the three anymore. That's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had a great time. I want to thank the committee, Yogi, God bless you. Thank you for your calls. And Joel and Boogie, you know that I love you, and I just love you more. And thank you for your love and your hospitality, and I've never been treated better. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And everybody on the committee and everybody here has been delightful to me. I don't know that I've ever been treated better, and I just thank God for the present, and I thank God for you, and I thank God that I'm here, because I don't know about you, but all my life, I always wanted to be somebody else, some other place, and at some other time. It just seemed to be that it'd be a lot more convenient, and it's quite clear to me tonight that I am exactly where I'm supposed to be, and I like who I am when I am with you. And I'm delighted to be here. For those of you who don't know me, no, I don't play basketball. Yes, I have trouble buying clothes, and the weather's fine out here. All right? We'll get through those right now, you know. It's always the same person that asks the same question, and they're always the same height. First question is, how tall are you? 6'10". Oh, do you play basketball? No, how tall are you? 5'6". Do you play miniature golf? Seems fair to me, Howard. I come from a very elite group of people called white trash, and we worked hard to uphold our image. There wasn't much doubt. You could see the family lines as we come down the street, and I was the youngest of 7 children, and my father was a foundry worker. He was one of the hardest working men I'd ever known in my life, and he was also one of the hardest drinking men I'd ever known in my life. And I had a mother that liked to take us to church and a father that wouldn't set foot in it. And I used to go to church, and my experiences at churches, it was a Lutheran church, and I remember, I don't know about you, but when I went to church, that pastor, and you can always tell a pastor because they got thin blue lips, talk like this, you know. And that pastor used to look at me and say, "You're going to burn in hell, young man. That's what you're going to do. You're going to burn in hell." And I thought, well, okay. And I'd go there, and I didn't quite get it, because I kept hearing the same thing over and over and over. At least it seemed to me. God is responsible for everything. God is responsible for everything. Well, I don't know about you, but things weren't going too well at my house. I can remember waking up in the middle of the night going to get a glass of water, and you turn on that light and a million cockroaches run everywhere. And they crunch under your feet as you go to that sink and you shake out the glass before you get the glass of water. And you take a long drink and try to forget about what's going on around you, and you think to yourself, God is responsible for everything. When the cops come and take Dad away in handcuffs again, and Mom's face is bleeding, maybe. Or Dad's face is bleeding, maybe. And they take him away, and you know he spent food money again. There's not going to be any money for groceries. And I think to myself, you know, God is responsible for everything. And when I go to school and I was wearing those hand-me-downs, because I was the youngest of seven, I figured out later on in life, if I outgrew them, they had to wear mine. But it took me some time to figure that out. And people used to say rude things to me all the time, rude things to me about how I smelled and the way I looked and my floppy shoes. And I'd think to myself, God is responsible for everything. You know, it wasn't long before I didn't like God too much. A lot of people come say, hey, and said, I was an atheist. I didn't believe in God. I believed in God, and I hated everything I believed when I got here. He was a vicious man that kept a book and was going to send me to hell. So I argued with him. Everything he talked about, said was bad, I enjoyed. And I wasn't nine yet. So why even pay any attention to it, you know? I very early in life, and people started being ripped out of my life at a very early age. I come up from a family where there was a lot of tragic deaths over and over, and people come up to me. I remember my cousin Linda. Linda, if there was ever a godly person and a wonderful person and a good person, it was Linda. Linda got straight A's. She had a full scholarship at college. She was just wonderful, and she was walking across the street, and a truck hit her and knocked 100 feet, and she died. Do you know what people said to me? God must have wanted another angel. I said, oh, so he hits you with a truck. That's the kind of God I want to be praying to. And they meant it. And I thought, I don't want anything to do with this guy. Yet, you know, there was times in my drinking and that where I can remember beating on the door of a church at 3 o'clock in the morning, saying, help me. And the doors were locked. So yet I always told everybody I hated it. I longed to feel something in that area. I don't know when I took my first drink. I was very young. I just knew it did something very important to me. It made it so the world didn't matter so much. Cricket talked about not feeling. And I'm pretty much that way too. I knew one thing at a very early age. I could not afford to feel. And I was a crybaby. That's what they called it then. I got touched very easily, and I'd cry, and you learn not to do that pretty quick, because they call you sissy, and they want to fight you. So then when you start crying, you just say, I'm so mad I started crying, and then you beat them up really bad, you know. And, you know, there isn't a day that goes by today where I'm not reduced to tears for something. All my life, in all my sobriety, I've learned something that maybe all of you knew. I didn't know that I started out the way God wanted me to be. I didn't want to lie. Didn't want to cheat. All I wanted to do was be a good guy and try to help where I could. Now, you couldn't tell that by what I did. And my major mistake was trying to please everybody else around me. When they told me I was to be a tough guy, I tried. I'm a cop fighter. Any other cop fighters in here? Yeah, you're stupid too, you know? Think about it. There's always more cops than there is you, you know? And somehow I got this idea I could win sometime. And yet later on in life, I was just hoping they'd take me out. When I came to AA, they kept saying, I came to my first AA meeting when I was 10 years old. I've got a brother sober in South Carolina, half-brother. For 44 years, he's so dry we don't let people smoke around him anymore, you know. And he took me to this meeting, and I remember going to that AA meeting, and there was some old guy up there about 30 saying, my name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic, and I thought, good for you, Fred, you know. And I thought, if I ever get old and burn out, I'll end up here too. Well, I didn't know I was a prophet at that point, but seems that I was. And there was something about AA, though, where they were nice. And I couldn't figure that out, because that hadn't happened before, at least in my world. Was kicked out of school at the age of 13. I was halfway through seventh grade, and the same word they used for cricket, incorrigible, and a few other things. And I said, fine, I didn't want to go to your school anyway, because from a very early age, I knew one thing. You see, I'm not very bright, and I'm not going to tell you that. I'm going to tell you I got it going. But what I felt like was I'm not too bright, you see. Probably couldn't pass those tests even if I studied. So I'll just be the tough guy, and I'll do my thing. And I was put out into a world of I was 13 running around with guys 23 and 26 years old, and they taught me a new trade right away. It was burglary, and I appreciated it. But I grew out of that career real quick. You know, when you're my height, it's real easy to pick out in the lineup. It was him. But I appreciated it, you know. But there was something that went on there, and I noticed a lot of big guys and gals. I hope you're not offended by gals. I got a lecture on the word gals a while back. To me, gals mean like a guy. Big guys and gals, and nice. And God bless them. And I forgot where I was at. I got to start all over now. Hi, my name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. But I never really learned it until quite a few years sober. You see, when I was 13, I was drinking in bars with no ID. And people always expected me, because I looked 21, to act 21. And when I didn't, they were disappointed in me, and so was I, because I'd say there's something wrong with me. And the reality was, no, there wasn't something wrong with me. I was 13. And I didn't know that. Took me a number of years to figure that out. I've got a 16-year-old son now who's just turned 16 in February, and he's 6'4" and wears his 15 shoe. And he came out and spent the summer with me, and I sat him down and I said, son, I want you to remember one thing. If you don't remember anything else I told you, it's okay to be 16. I don't care what they want from you. I don't care what they think of you. I don't care what they expect of you. You be who you are. You be who you are. See, I'd never heard that before I came to AA. I always heard I had to be something other than what I was, because what I was wasn't sufficient for anything, anywhere I went. I knew from a very early age that something was very wrong with me. And I didn't know why, and I didn't know what. I just knew it was true. And if you're like me, if you drink, it takes that away, at least temporarily, till you wake up again. And then after a while, when you drink, you know what to do when you wake up again. You drink some more. And when that's the cycle that begins, if you're like me, you're in a world of trouble. Because it won't stop on your own accord. I got married when I was 16 years old. Excuse me. Yeah, 16 years old. I had a son when I was 17. I'd been to Chicago once, figured I was a man now. I don't know what that has to do with anything, but it made sense at the time. And you couldn't tell me much anything. And my life was going down my sleeve. I, too, was one of them when somebody offered me something, I didn't say, what is that? What effect will it have? I was, oh, thanks. Got any more? Got any more? Thanks. And I was one of those who said I'd never inject anything. Well, I found out that I'm a liar there, too. Because after a while, the pain of living gets so bad, you don't mind a little twinge for a second. You just don't mind. One of my goals was to die. I come to AA and they said, if you keep drinking and using, you're going to die. It's a lie. If you're like me, you might live. And I don't know about you, but that scared the hell out of me. Because I was always counting on dying. Police to take me out. Good fight, take me out. Go out in glory. Go out in glory. Everybody will love you then. And then one day I realized, what if I don't die with my rotten luck? I might live forever and just slip down a rung a day at a time. Now, that terrified me. I don't know about you. January 5th of 1971, I got sober. I really didn't mean to. I looked in my day planner. It wasn't in there, you know. I was in an accident one more time, and I was laying in the middle of the street in Davenport, Iowa. And it was 18 below zero, wind chill factor. And I remember I was laying in the middle of the street pretending like I was knocked out. I don't know why, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. And I heard the policeman come up in the squad cars, and I'm laying there, and I heard the policeman say, "That's Mutum. Don't touch him. He's the scum of the earth. Car's probably hot. Let him freeze." And they didn't even cover me. And I agreed. My fight was gone. I knew, somehow in retrospect, I can tell you, that the finest judgments I could come up with put me in that spot. There was nobody else to blame anymore. Not the way I was raised, not the way I was rejected by society, not all that nonsense. It was just a matter of, I'm the common denominator in all my troubles. And they rolled me into a hospital, and some nurse said, "Do you want me to call AA?" And I went, "Might as well." Now, I want to know why you newer people can't be sincere like we were in the old days. Right? I used to say that, believe it or not. And I remember this guy came up to make a 12-step call on me. His name was Hap. Now, there's a guy you want to see when you're hungover. A guy named Hap that always smiles. And he walked into my room and said, "My name's Hap, and I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous." And I thought, oh, man, because I'd been to A&A. I'd heard it. "You're not even dry behind the ears. I spilled more than you ever drank. You ain't even around the block yet." I was 20 years old. And by the time I was 20 years old, I'd been married and divorced. I had records as long as both arms. I'd been committed to the Iowa State Mental Institution, termed psychotic, neurotic, insanely violent, hopelessly addicted to drugs, and chronic alcoholic. And I got 2 warrants out for felonies right now, and they're telling me I haven't been around the block. And I'm thinking, how big is this block? If it's much bigger, I'm not going to make it. And the reason I share that with you is just because somebody's young don't mean they're as dead as you were when you walked in the door. Cancer don't care how old you are. It'll kill you. I was 20 years old going on 104. I was a tired, tired man. Boy. Wanted to be a man in the worst way, but I was a boy in all the ways that were important. And I hurt, and I didn't have any answers. And when Hap came in that day, he said, "We don't drink and we don't use, one day at a time." And I said, "I'll try." After telling him, "I don't think I can make it. I don't think I can make it a whole day without something. You see, when my head gets going and my guts get going, I'll try." And that's the only thing I've done consistently since January 5th of 1971, which is my sobriety date, which is chemically free. I am one of those that just happen to believe that. Now, there's some that don't. There's some that don't, and I value your opinion so much, I'll let you keep it to yourself afterwards. You know, it's awful funny. There's a lot of people around rationalizing all that. In the business I'm in, I do their funerals. The ones who rationalize that it's okay for them to do that never show up at funerals. Odd, isn't it? They're at meetings telling people, "You don't have to do that. That's just that old fuddy-duddy stuff. You don't have to go to all those meetings. Oh, it's non-addictive. Go ahead." Yeah, they're never at the funerals, I promise. I'm there. I started going to AA meetings. They said you had to be honest, and I thought, okay, I'll quit stealing. Well, no, I'm in it. I just do enough to make ends meet, you know, not anything extravagant. And they said, no, you got to stop it all. And then they give me the toughest assignment I ever had in my life. They said, you got to start being honest with yourself. Lord, I didn't know the truth anymore. I, honest to God, didn't. I can remember having a fake ID when I was 18, just in case I'd ever need it. And then I got my draft card. And I'm sitting there looking at the two, and honest to God, I couldn't tell you which one I was. I couldn't tell you. And I remember looking at the draft card, and I couldn't distinguish it. You see, it wasn't so much my dishonesty with you. It certainly had a lot to do with it, but it was the dishonesty with me. In order for me to survive and rationalize my survival, I had to buy a lot of crap. A lot of crap about myself, and I had to justify. You know, when I took my first inventory, if somebody would have looked at it, they would have thought I would have been nothing less than a brute if I hadn't done all those things, you know? I'd rationalized everything. I remember when they talked about a moral inventory, I raised my hand in the meeting, I said, by whose morals, yours or mine? If they're by your morals, I'm in trouble. If they're by mine, everything's justified. And guess what? They weren't by my morals. And I went to meetings, and I remember there was this minister in the group, had thin blue lips, talk like this. And he said to me one day, Ed, why don't you come back to church? And at about 6 months sober, you get honesty. At about 8 months, you get a little tact to go with it. I was at about 7 months, and I told him, I said, I'll tell you why I don't go to church. It's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars. And he said, why don't you come? One more won't hurt. Remember walking into a meeting, the guy put his arm around me. And he said, I love you, man. I said, I don't play that stuff. I'm just here to get sober. You know what I mean? You just back off and go sit in your little chair. We'll get along just fine. And when I saw him last week, I said, I love you too, John. Do you know that anybody who worked with me when I was newly sober is still sober? Isn't that amazing? You know, now you see people come and go like it's a swinging door. It's not supposed to be. Slipping and whatever else they call it is an option. You really don't have to do that. It's not required. You know? You can come in here and do this thing if you want. And it just touched me because we had a celebration in January for my 30-year birthday. And everybody who had a major part in my life, all seven of them, were there, still continuously sober. It's not a question of whether AA works. It's a question of if you'll take it as it's written in the book or listen to all the nonsense going around labeled Alcoholics Anonymous. And But I go to meetings, and one of the things that bothered me when I started going to meetings, I started saying the G word, God. Now, I liked Howard's talk today, and I agree with what he said, but if somebody would have said Jesus, we would have fought. Yeah, they would have been picking their hat out of a new place, you know, because I was violently anti-religious. As I said earlier, I hated the God that I was taught, at least that I learned about. And I'd fight you at the drop of the hat, because I already told you. They ripped everybody I loved out of my life. They put me through hell because he's responsible for everything. And when they said, you know, the only way you're going to stay sober is to have a relationship with God, a personal relationship with God, like it says in this book on page 10. And and that bothered me because I told you how I felt about God. And then they said something really good. They said, you know, it's God as you understand him. And I, again, agree. If somebody believes in a doorknob and they can really believe it, go for it. Just make sure you're telling the truth about what you believe. I made a major mistake. I would walk into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's what they call old-timers around there. And they would talk to me about God, and they'd talk to me about miracles in their life, and I would look into their eyes, and they were telling me the truth. I knew they were telling me the truth. I didn't get the angle they were shooting, but I knew they were telling me the truth. So I started parroting what I heard. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. Live and let live, day at a time. Easy does it. I took it so easy, they had to nudge me to breathe every now and then, you know. God, that all sounded good. It sounded wonderful. And I came to believe my God would be, and I really fixed him with this one, my God was going to be kind and loving and forgiving. Guess I showed them, huh? That's what my God was going to be. And I'll tell you something. If you haven't taken the time to figure out who your God is, I'm not talking about what you were taught. I'm talking about what you believe. And if you don't start there, you're starting from a lie. So take a minute to figure out what you believe. Because it's your concept of God that your life depends on, not mine. It's yours. And, but I started mouthing words that I didn't know. They were beyond my experience. They were true words, but of their experience. And I was about a year sober. And my dad asked me over for dinner. Now, I don't know about you, but when Dad asks you to come over from dinner, you're in trouble, you know? But I've been hanging around these AA folks for over a little over a year now in continuous sobriety, and they said, we go into old situations with new attitudes, trying to create a better situation. So I walked into that situation expecting to be yelled at, but going there with a new attitude. Because my dad worked hard all his life. And none of us appreciated it, really. And that night during dinner, he stopped in the middle of the meal and he said, boy, and I thought, oh, God, here we go. He said, I want to tell you something. And I said, yeah, Pop. And he said, I'm really proud of you. Now, if you had told me I ever wanted that old fool's approval, I would have said, you're crazy. He's a drunk. He don't mean nothing. Now, even though that year I got sober, he was trying to get sober, really trying. He was one of those people that we call chronic. Not everybody can get sober. I think we forget that. That's another thing with that slipping time and time again. You know, this is a disease, and when your lungs are filled with cancer, there is very few shots, unless a miracle, that you're going to stay alive. It's the same when your heart and your mind and your body is filled with alcoholism. It's just as debilitating, and it takes an equal miracle for that to happen. And my dad was trying. And I mean, the buttons on my shirt that night just popped. I thought, you know, I didn't care what he thought of me is what I thought until he told me he loved me and he was proud of me. And to that date, it was the best day of my sobriety ever. And I'd never expected it. You see, if you're new tonight, those are the kind of things that are going to happen to you that'll build your heart and your mind up like you've never known. And they're called acts of grace by God. At least that's my understanding. Those are the things that are going to happen when you don't expect it and when you least expect it. And it's something that's going to make you want to keep coming back and walk with that newcomer from where they're at, not where you're at, to bring them to where you're at. And it was just wonderful. And I went to the meeting that night, and after the meeting got out, I went to my sister-in-law's, and I got a phone call from my mother. And she was crying and hysterical, and I said, Mom, what's wrong? And she said, Ed, Dad went across the street to get him a quart of beer and me a bottle of pop, and they're carrying bodies out of there now. I don't know what's going on. Can you come home? And I said, sure, Mom. And I got in my car, and I thought, well, I'm sober now. Everything's good. Nothing bad can really happen, so it wasn't a big deal, you know. And I'm driving across town, and I go to the bar I used to drink in every day. And I walk up there, and I've never seen so many police in all my life. And it's funny how those cops had shaped up in that year. I was working in the court, through the court system, to help people. You know, they don't arrest you when you don't swing at them. I figured that out. But they had also seen a change in me, and they respected it. They respected the change. And I walked into that tavern, and one of the officers said, Ed, what are you doing here? And I said, my dad was in here. He said, oh, my God, Ed. I said, well, what's going on? He said, we don't know. We just know that somebody walked in and shot everybody. And I looked out and I saw a pool of blood with my father's glasses all smashed up in it. And I said, well, where'd they take him? He said, they're all up at the hospital. So I got in my car and I went up to the hospital. And there was an officer there that hadn't forgotten me. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, my father was in that bar. He said, ah, your old man isn't in there. And you get out of here before we bust you. You're coming up here with your stuff. Miracle happened. I just said, yes, okay, and I left. A year and a half before, they would have been getting a new lieutenant. But by what you had taught me, by your example, one little thing kept going through my head, live and let live. And at times, I didn't want it to, but it kept going on. I went home, and I called the officer that had spent the last 5 years of his career trying to put me away. His name's Bob Garner, and he was on the narco division in the Quad Cities, and I called him up because he knew I was sober, too. He had me tailed everywhere. Everybody knew I was sober. The bad guys thought I was a narc, and the good guys thought I had a big drug deal going, so I had company everywhere I went. And I said, Bob, my dad was in there, and he said, oh, my God, Ed, hold on. And he fed me information that comes in, and he said, all we can come up with is they were shot and wandered outside where they took him hostage. So we'll form a search party. And it was one of those Midwest ice storms where the cars were sliding into other cars. It was just a mess. You couldn't stand up. And all night long, we looked under parked cars and on the benches. And you don't want to, but you got it. Your dad might be there. And at 8 o'clock the next morning, that officer from the hospital called me up and said, "Well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. Would you come up and identify your dad?" And I said, "Okay." And I walked up there and I walked into that morgue and I saw my father with that bullet hole in his face. Because I remembered the God that had the book. And I really thought he'd killed Dad because of what I'd done. They always told me, get me, that he'd punish you and that he'd ravage your relatives. And I thought he shot Dad just for what I did and all that I thought I believed. I reached for that and there was nothing there because it was everybody else's beliefs rather than mine. And it got cold in that morgue, a lot colder than it should have been. And I had reason in the last few years to recall that date in great detail, and I realized something. That when I walked out, everywhere I went, right off to the side, would be a member of AA. Just standing there. Make an eye contact with me. Let me know they were there. They didn't bother me. Didn't say anything. They just make eye contact. Give me a little nod. They were loving me. They were taking care of me. And they're just like my God. He's everywhere I go if I just pay attention. And I remember, God, the war inside. And I don't know if you've ever had anybody murdered in your family. And I, please, God, I hope you never do. But don't say stupid stuff to them. You know? I sat down with a few members of AA who were, quote-unquote, some old-timers, not the ones that were at my anniversary, but some other ones. And I tried to tell them how I felt. And they got up and walked away. They said, "We thought you had a good program." Talk about feeling left alone. I'll tell you something. If you're working with people that won't work with you out of where you're at, start working with somebody else. Start working with people who's going to share from their experience, not pontificate on some plateau that they haven't reached yet. Very important. Because it almost cost me my life. I thought, that was one of the first times sober I thought about suicide. I thought, well, okay. And I left there, and the guy that did my funeral, or my funeral, my father's funeral, and in a sense, my funeral for the way I used to believe in God. My dad, as I told you starting off, he never went to church, but he was sick 6 months before he died. And out of the blue, he called a priest and was baptized. And it shocked Mom and everybody because that's not Dad, but he did that. And Mom thought it would only be appropriate for this priest to do the funeral. So this priest came and we did the funeral, and it was still noted until, sadly, this weekend, Iowa's most horrendous crime. And God, everybody was there. Just thousands of people came. And he said something that gave me one of the keys to the kingdom. He said, "You know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will." And he said, "I don't believe that." He said, "I believe God created human beings and gave them a free will. Some of those human beings chose to do this act, and now it's God's will." It was like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. You see, all my life I kept thinking, if there's a God, why are the babies starving? Guess why? We ain't feeding them. God has nothing to do with it. There's people dying of cancer all over. Why is that? Because we pollute everything we touch. Don't blame it on God anymore. I go out to Oklahoma City and speak. And I've been to that memorial a number of times where the bombing took place. And I remember the day that happened, Billy Graham saying, "I don't know why God let this happen." And I said, "Billy, you don't get it either, do you?" But somebody got it, because out at that memorial, right across the street, is a statue of Christ with his back to the bombing. And he's got his head in his hands and he's weeping. And it simply said, "And Jesus wept." You see, that's my kind of God. That wouldn't have anything to do with those kind of things. Wouldn't rip people out of our lives. just made me feel a little better. Made me feel better about God. And I was, I had been in the... Yes, it did. And I'd been working in the alcoholism field. It was wonderful at that time. You didn't need much education to be an expert, and I fit the bill. And please God, I did something there to help somebody. But God talked to me one day. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. I do believe God talks to you. But that's what sponsors are for. They edit the messages. I remember one time I went to my sponsor and I said, Clancy, God told me to... He said, Ed, this message looks strangely like your handwriting. And it was. But this time, God talked to me and he said, Ed, go out to California, get into show business. I thought about my resume and it made perfect sense. So I went to where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I got a job as Goofy at Disneyland. Little did they know how well I fit the role at that point. But 2.5 years sober and just stark raving sober. And I wasn't going to AA too much anymore. I just go there because God told me to. But I didn't talk to anybody there because I told you about the AAs I talked to and they got up and walked away. So I was a little afraid of that. And I was sitting in... I didn't actually take that job as Goofy. And I promise you, Disney is... tremendously grateful for that. But I went up to a meeting in West L.A., and there was a guy up there in a group, and they were talking about sobriety, and they were talking about doing things. I don't know about you, but I was used to being around groups where if you had a birthday, somebody stood up, you flipped them a chip, and they sat down. Oh, good, isn't this wonderful? You know. And I'm 22 years old. I need a little more happening in my life. And they were talking about living. They didn't talk about service. They were service. If there was anything to be done, they were a part of it, and they were doing it, and that intrigued me. And the next week, I walked up there, and there was this guy walking around, and I didn't know who he was, but I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? He said, no. And I kind of knew the A&A rules, you know. If they ask you, you got to do it. And he said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. And I thought, oh, good, tall jokes. That's what I need. That'll make me feel more a part of. And he said, my name's Clancy, and I'll be glad to be your sponsor. And, well, no, he didn't say I'd be glad to. He said, if you agree to do a few things, he'd sponsor you. And I'm grateful he put it that way, because I try to do as little as possible. Thank you very much. And I especially did that even though I was fighting for my life. I didn't know any better. And I'm real grateful I didn't hear a lot of the nonsense that goes around about the man, because to be quite honest with you, If I'd listened to some of you, you would have killed me. Because I would have never talked to him, ever. I try not to put down any individual or group in Alcoholics Anonymous. I may not like what they do. I may not like what they stand for. I may not like how they do it. But I want to give you the dignity of your own decision. I have no right to take that from you. And I started going to meetings. And, you know, he's goofy. He wants you to actually do these steps. And I remember I wanted to go to discussion meetings. He said, no, you're not going to any discussion meetings, Ed, because you're the type of guy, when the meeting starts, you're going to think about what you're going to say. Then it's going to get to your time, and you're going to talk, and then you're going to spend the rest of the meeting thinking about what you should have said. How'd he know? And so I didn't go to discussion meetings for years. And I lived in Clancy's garage, and that's when I met Howard. I was living in his garage, and he made me write an inventory over again, and I had to tell the truth, and I had to take it with him. And so I wrote for 4 days and four nights, and I wrote this inventory, and I told the truth. I mean, I poured it out. And I went in the house, and Clancy's wife, Charlotte, was in the house, and we had a cup of coffee, kind of celebrated me finishing that fourth step. And I go back out to the garage, and at that time, he had a goat named Alfred. And Alfred had gotten into the garage, and he was finishing off the last page. True story. I got crazy. I went up to Charlotte and said, Charlotte, that goat ate my inventory. She said, oh, my God, I bet she found that hard to swallow, you know. No, what Charlotte said, I'm sorry, I got that backwards. What Charlotte said is, oh, my God, I hope he don't have the run. And Clancy said, I bet she found that hard to swallow. And what really broke my heart is 3 days later, the goat died. True story. Some sort of intestinal blockage. I don't know. But I started all over, and he said, I want you to go into those meetings and start shaking hands. And I, you know, the group was small then. It was only about 400 people. And he said, I want you to go in there and shake their hands. I said, I don't like them people. He said, they don't like you either. Go shake their hands. And I go, hi, I'm Ed. Hi, I'm Ed. I'm Ed, you know. And I had something that I regret deeply, and I didn't even know I had. I had a smart mouth. I had a mouth that could rip people to shreds. And you know, a lot of that goes on in AA, and I don't think this is the place for it. Just my personal opinion. But I was good at it. I was really good at it. And I could reduce people to tears. And I had started all over with God. I followed the advice I suggested with you. I got down to what do I believe God is. My first honest prayer ever was on my knees saying, God, I don't know if you're there or not. I sure hope so. It's the truth. That's all I knew. And I remember Clancy calling me to his office a couple of times and saying, Eddie, the very people who love you, you're driving away with your mouth. You need to stop. And I am so grateful for people who love me enough to tell me those things. I am so grateful for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, in spite of my size, who walked up to me and said, Ed, we don't talk that way in AA. If you want to talk that way, you go out and hang out with your little street punk friends and talk out there. We don't talk that way. We're talking about a higher form of living here, not bringing your old ideas in here and calling them new. And I really appreciated that. And I really appreciated them telling me, Ed, you smell bad, buddy. You need to go home. Because you see, it had been so long since I cared what anybody thought of me. I didn't know. I can explain Clancy and my relationship by one little story. I'm in the back bathroom in his house and when I was living there. And I'm shaving one day, and Clancy comes in and said, what are you doing? I said, shaving. He said, okay, here. He said, turn on the hot water. And I said, okay. He said, now let it get nice and hot. And I said, okay. And he said, now put that on your beard. And I said, okay. He said, now if you reach up there, there's some shaving cream. He said, oh, you can use the bar soap. I used the shaving cream. He said, now put that on. Let it set for a second and soak it. And I said, okay. And he said, now shave. And I went, oh. You see, I learned to shave in Scott County Jail when I was 13 years old. You don't ask people anything in jail. I just picked up the razor and shaved. Sometimes I got pretty bloody, but I shaved. And Clancy didn't put me down at all about it. He just taught me a better way to shave. You know, when I was a kid, I had a bad speech impediment. And I talked with a very bad lisp, like this, and people made fun of me. And so in school, they sent me to therapy. And I can remember this woman who was working with me had me playing with blocks. And I'm saying, why this woman made me play with these blocks? I'm here for my speech impediment, and see the talking all this stuff made me play with these. I don't like playing with these blocks. And she's talking to me, and she's telling me to do things, and she's telling me to concentrate on the blocks. Okay, I don't know what I have to do with it. I'll play with the blocks. And then one day she said, Ed, you don't have to come here anymore. And I said, why? I like playing with the blocks. And my impediment was gone. You see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Those blocks we call steps, and they don't have to make sense to you. You just keep using them and keep using them and talk to the people around you, and before long, your impediment will be arrested. And if you continue with the blocks, you don't have to go back to that speech therapist anymore. We got a lot of people here who had a lot of potential all your life.
Oh, you've got so much potential. You have so much to offer. We got any more of those in there?
Yeah,
oh, if you only knew what you had to offer. You're just such a precious boy.
They were right. I was wrong. All my life, people told me that. And because I didn't feel good about me, I didn't believe them. They were right. And they're right about you. You've got more to offer this world than you've ever dreamed of it. but you won't do a thing until you get out of the way. And I learned that here. I remember I was going to a meeting in Pasadena, California, and Pasadena is a wealthy area, and I thought, ooh, Pasadena, I may hook up with a job, I may, and I caught myself, and I went in and I said this very same prayer I said on these stairs right before I started, or before the 720 thing started. And I said, Father, save me from my own nonsense, and let me just share the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and what you've done in my life. And I went and I shared at that meeting. And after the meeting, a guy came up to me and said, this makes no sense to me, but I want to offer you a job. I said, it makes perfect sense to me. Thank you very much. And that was in Pasadena on Saturday. He said, have you ever been in show business management? I said, no. He said, do you speak Taiwanese? I said, no. He said, be in my office Monday morning. Monday morning, I went into his office, met with the producer of the Marathon Ice Skating Review, and that Thursday, I was lifting out of LAX, going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was the new vice president of America on Ice. I was going over there and representing a cast of 63. I was negotiating with the Taiwanese government to form contracts and build the stage and set and prepare for the cast and crew to come over. So how was your week? Now, I'll tell you what was missing there. I don't know about you, but I spent most of my life dragging around this big bag of stuff. Big bag of stuff. All my life. And it seems that I dragged this bag with me and something bad had happened. I just put it in the bag and drag it to the next day of living. And when I got to AA, they said, leave that bag there. Now, what does that have to do with what I just said? There was a time in my life where I wasn't even gone for the interview. Oh, man, I only got a seventh grade education. I had records as long as my arm. And what you've taught me is to suit up and show up. Walk toward the light. We're familiar with the dark, but you don't have to stay there. Walk toward the light. And I suited up and I showed up for that interview. And I went over there and I spent time in Taiwan. I remember when I got off the plane, everybody was this tall. And they were looking at me and I was looking at them. And I thought, it's just a matter of time before they strap me down, you know? I saw that Gulliver Travels. I know what they're going to do. And I had a wonderful time over there, and I won't spend a lot of time on that, but I need to tell you part of that. I'm in Kaohsiung, Taiwan, and a guy walks by me one day and said, you know, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I went, yeah, good. And I finished that tour, and I came home, and 3 months later, I got a call from Hollywood, California, from the Harlem Globetrotters office. And they said, we've heard wonderful things about you. Would you come and talk to us? And I walked toward the light. And they asked me about my life and who I am and what I'm about. And I told them, as honestly as I'm talking to you tonight. And they said, you're hired. And I got on a plane and I flew to Madison Square Garden and I was the new manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. I got on the bus and there's Metal Arc Lemon and Curly Neal and Marcus Haynes. And I got all the money, you know. To that point, it had never been better. To that point, I'll tell you, when I was on East 6th Street in Davenport, Iowa, I used to have dreams. I don't call them fantasies. Dreams for me were what God gave me. Fantasies is what I create. But I had a dream of someday traveling around the world, first class, meeting kings and queens and presidents, and just doing that. No, I went to AA and you shared something with me that I want to share with you tonight. Go back and grab those dreams. I really don't care how old you are. Those dreams were a gift. Quit throwing it away. And I dared to grab onto those dreams, and guess what I was doing? I was traveling around the world, meeting kings and queens and presidents, first class. I don't know about you, but my God is good. I went to London, England, and I met the daughter of the Turkish ambassador. She was one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. She was wealthy. She was Muslim. I figured our backgrounds were a lot alike, so we got married. I didn't say all my judgment had returned, or hers. And we were married, and she is a delightful lady, who at that time really didn't understand Alcoholics Anonymous. Plus, I wasn't a very good mate.
I wasn't used to thinking about you more than about me. And when that happens, at least in my experience, it's a painful, painful event. And we were together 10 years, and it was difficult. And I remember the day I come home from work, and she asked me to leave, and I dropped to the floor sobbing, saying, please, I don't want to leave, please. And I had to leave. And for the next 10 years, my children were told I abandoned them. But if you got a program, they can say what they want. You see, if you're not doing anything wrong, there's nothing to defend. And I didn't know that till I got here. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a dignity and a grace and a belief in God where I can walk through the worst of accusations and know that it's all going to be all right in time. Maybe not my time, but in time. When I was 18 years sober, I made a decision based on self that cost me everything I owned. Everything. Notice that I took all the blame. I made the decision on greed. I didn't pray about it. I didn't ask my sponsor about it. They offered me a lot of money if I signed this deal and invested so much, and I did it. And within 3 months, I was wiped out. And they were evicting me out of my apartment. And I kept thinking, at 18 years sober, how can they do this? Because I was going to meetings, and I was sharing my experience, strength, and hope, and I was doing all that, but something happened to me that was so subtle, and I had no idea that the things out here had once again become my God, without me even knowing it. They were what I thought you saw in me, who I worked for, where I'd been. And they became my God, and when they went away, I had to start fresh and new, and I'm real grateful for that. I went back to Iowa, started all over. In 1988, I started a house for recovering people. And it wasn't a treatment center, it wasn't a halfway house. I was just going to meetings and out there, and I noticed a lot of people, young, who were trying to stay sober and had no place to stay. And I made the covenant with myself some years ago. I don't criticize anything unless I'm doing my part to correct it. Well, it really limits my conversation, but at least I'm not a hypocrite as much as I used to be, you know. And so I got this place going. It's the first selfless thing I've ever done. That's why I brought it up. It ain't about it happening. It's about all I wanted to do for the first time in my life is give. I'm not worried about what I get anymore. I'm just not worried. I read that part in the big book where it says, we are reborn. I read that part in the big book that said, happy, joyous, and free. And I dared to believe that they meant it. And that if I am not experiencing that, it's because I'm doing something wrong in my life. So I started all over. I started all over, you know, and I got back to work. And in 1992, I was in pretty good shape. I had gotten a little place to stay, and things were going good. And I decided to quit smoking, you know. And one day I went... maybe this isn't good for me. And so I quit. And they told me to go out and start running and exercising and that. So I went out and I got the shoes and I'm doing the stretching and I went out and broke my leg. And I'm sitting there with my foot up and kind of reviewing my life and actually kind of feeling pretty good about it. Kind of patting me on the back. Well, things are going good. And all of a sudden God said to me, Ed, what about education? And I wanted to go, la, 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 la. And immediately when God said that, I said, you don't understand. I've been head of multi-million-dollar corporations. I've been manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. I've been that. And all the while I was doing that, I got my crutches and I hobbled over to the university. And I went into the university and I said, I need to go to school. And they said, how many credits do you have? I said, I have bad credits. Why? What's that got to do with it? And they did the very same thing you did. They laughed at me, and I shared with them a gift that I absolutely treasure that you gave me. I looked them right in the eye, and I said, you don't understand. I don't know how to go to school. I don't know if I'm smart enough to pass the class. But I want to try. Would you help me? And they said, yes. And I started going to school, working full-time, school full-time, and didn't drop one activity in AA. You know, I'm not the one to come up and say, gee, I can't find the time. Just not the guy. Because God will create it for you if you really want to do it. He will take care of it, if at least my God will. I don't know about yours. Work on it.
but mine will. And I started going there, and a friend offered for me to go on a Christian retreat one weekend. And I went on that retreat, and I remember when I filled it out, they said, "What would you like to get out of this retreat?" And I said, "I'd like to feel a little closer to God." And during that retreat, I had no less than a spiritual awakening. And I do not have the words to describe it. I pray for someday I will. But it changed my heart and my mind and my life in a flash. You know, we talk about spiritual experiences, and for a number of years I had the educational kind. Don't limit yourself to that. Don't limit yourself just to that. When God acts, at least in my experience, it's life-changing. And he said to me that night, "Ed, I need you to be a minister." And I went, "Okay." And I left that retreat, and I immediately, that Monday, went up and signed up for seminary. I had 60 hours in toward my BA, and they told me I needed a BA, 120-hour BA, and then I had to go on and get a 96-hour Master's of Divinity degree. And I said, "Okay." And I started the work, and I started to pastor right away. I remember the first time I was in my church and in one of my congregation, I got called, and this was a guy I loved. He's a hard-working man. He's a farmer. He don't ask for anything, but he takes care of everything he can and everybody. And I got a call, and Harold had a radical stomach cancer and had 3 months to live. And his wife and his daughter said, "Would you please come and talk to Dad?" And I said, "Sure." And I drove right out there. And I'm doing on-the-job training. I thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to pray, but I don't feel like praying. So we're sitting there, and Harold's sitting in his room, and it's a big bay window. And I'm just not feeling like praying, and I'm watching him. And every once in a while, Harold would look out his window and look at his yard and turn his head back. And then I realized Harold was a very proud man. He always kept his yard on the farm immaculate. And I looked out, and it was pretty long. And I said, "Harold, can I mow your lawn?" He turned to me and said, "Would you do that, Pastor Ed?" I said, "You bet." For 3.5 months on Monday. It took me 4.5 hours. But I did the best praying I ever did with Harold by mowing his lawn. You see, we're called to be what they need us to be, not so much what we think they need. And I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember when I was asked to baptize a baby, and it just took my breath away. I remember one time when I was really wrestling with this whole minister thing, and I thought, "God, you remember who I am? This is the big guy. This is Ed. Are you sure? Are you absolutely sure?" And it says in our book not to say selfish prayers, but I did. I said, "God, I need to know if it's me, because I've got to hold my life to a higher standard than I've ever dreamed of, because I don't take it lightly. And I'm willing to do that, but I need you to tell me that you want me." And I flipped to a part in the Bible that's in the back if you'd like to find it sometime. And it simply said, "Who better to show God's love and grace than one of the worst sinners of them all? The worse you've been, the more he loves you." God, I needed to hear that. "The worse you've been, the more he celebrates that you're turning around." Think about it. If you had a kid that was lost and came home, wouldn't you celebrate? And I never looked back. Last June, I got my master's degree, Master's of Divinity, and I was ordained. And those were two great days in my life. And it's all through Alcoholics Anonymous. Just because I, of my own, I'm not smart enough to go to school. 2 years ago, I was preaching to the congregation. I was trying to give them heaven because they had enough of hell. And I'm preaching about forgiveness. And I'm right in the middle, and there's in Matthew, there's a little verse about, "Don't come to me if you got a problem with your brother." And you see, I learned that in AA, too. If you have a resentment towards somebody, you go and talk to them. You don't go talk about them in a meeting. You go and talk to them. And try to get it straight. And if you can't get it straight, then get a sponsor or somebody involved. But you resolve that conflict. This is not a place where we stay sick. This is the place where we get better. And I was right in the middle of that sermon. I was right in the middle of that sermon, and I realized I had never forgiven the guys that had killed my father. And I stopped, and I said, "I'm sorry. I need to tell you that I have never forgiven the guys that..." And I couldn't even remember their names anymore. But I knew I'd never forgiven them, and I hadn't told them that. And I needed to tell them that. And I made a covenant with them right there that I'd do that. As God would have it, 2.5 weeks later, one of the guy's sentences was overturned, 28 years later. And the press came to me and said, what do you think? And I said, well, it's time to live and let live. It's time to heal. It's time to get on with the business of living. And they said, well, if they let this guy out, he's been in there 27 years. He isn't going to know how to work. He isn't going to know anything. What's he going to do? And I said, he can come live with me if he'd like to. And people were taken back by that. But you let me in here. You let me in your home. How dare I? How dare I? I mean, is there really a sin worse than another? There are no original sins. They've all been done and we've all been guilty. Who am I to say you can't come in my house when you let me in yours? If God would have it, 2.5 weeks later, about 3 weeks later, I was given the opportunity to go to prison to see a guy that I'd seen 28 years ago, testified against him, and thought in my heart and mind, you give me 5 minutes, we won't need this trial. Bring all five of those punks in here. We won't need the trial. And that's who I was going to see. And I caught myself going down that penitentiary row where I swear I'd never go back. My brother had spent so many years. And I'm going down there a changed man. And I'm praying what I pray every time I try to pray. And that's for God to help me be a reflection of who he would have me be. And I walked in and I saw Sherman. And Sherman was a bit taken back by my size. And I walked up to Sherman and I stuck out my hand. I said, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Newton. And I'm here to tell you that I love you and God loves you. And he forgives you and I forgive you. And if there's anything in my life I can do to make your life better, let me give it to you. I learned that in AA, too, by our friend Chuck. And right in front of me, I saw a lifer's heart melt. Stone-cold lifer looked at me, and I found a new friend. Hadn't planned on it. I didn't know how he was going to react. Didn't care. Just knew what I needed to do. And we prayed at the end of that meeting. And a few weeks later, they decided to retry him. In the state of Iowa, if you're with somebody who commits an act of violence with a gun, you're guilty of the same crime. So even though this had been overturned, he was there by his own testimony, so he'd spend the rest of his life in prison. And I went down to that county attorney who's seen me since 1988, working in the community and trying to do the best I can. And I walked in and I asked Bill if he'd grant my friend, my new friend, some mercy. And he said, Ed, this guy's conning me. I said, no, he's not conning me. He said, Ed, I'm telling you, this guy's conning me. He said, he can't be conning me. He don't even know I'm here. Now, I'll ask you again, sir. Will you grant my brother some mercy? And he said, yes. And instead of retrying, they let him plead to second-degree murder. And that was last year, and they said it'll be 5 years before he comes home, or a year before last, and it'll be 5 years before he comes home. And I remember that day we walked out, and there was press everywhere. And the press said to Sherman, this has got to be the greatest day of your life. And he said, oh, it's a good day. He said, but the best day of my life was when Reverend Ed came in and told me he loved me and he forgave me. Nobody ever told me that before. That was the day I became a free man, not today. That was the day. And I, well, that's great. And I told Sherman at that time, I said, Sherman, they don't know my God. Don't worry about that 5 years. They don't mind. My God does exactly what he wants when he wants. He don't really care what people think. And I said, it ain't going to be 5 years. I'm just telling you that now. And I had told him that a couple times before. And in 2 weeks, Sherman will be coming home. And the parole board made one condition. That he be involved with me on a daily basis. Do not tell me Alcoholics Anonymous does not work. Do not tell me that no matter where in your life you're at, there isn't hope. Wrong guy to tell it to. We're sitting in the middle of the biggest miracle that's hit this world in a long, long time. You know, we spend a lot of time saying in AA, you know, if you're pointing a finger at somebody else, there's three pointing back at you. And you know that's true. But the other part's true, too.
If you see something good in somebody else, you possess it as well. We're good people. We just need to learn how to be it. But if you see the goodness around you, it's because you possess it. It is not a mistake. And I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. My life is good. I wouldn't trade my life with anybody. And I know a lot of wonderful people that have a lot of wonderful lives. I'm not comparing. I'm just telling you that I wouldn't trade my life with anybody. Had to go to a meeting up in the for the church in Wisconsin. It always bothered me, you know, in Iowa, in Des Moines. It always bothered me that the guy that was the trigger man, they wouldn't let me get to make amends, to tell him he's forgiven. Because he had killed three other people in prison, and they put him in the federal system so far back, and they said, Ed, you're never going to find this guy, and you're never going to do it. And last week on Wednesday, I was up in Des Moines, Iowa, at a meeting for restorative justice, and it's a movement that's gaining great ground and working wonderfully, where you bring the perpetrators and the victims together so healing can begin for both instead of hatred forever. And that's what I participated in without knowing it, and now we're trying to get that done. And they asked me to tell my story about this restorative justice, how I'd experienced. And I did, and I said, you know, I only have one regret, that the trigger man I won't be able to talk to. Because the federal government has said, we will not give you where he's at. He's buried this way in the system, da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, that's my only regret, and I know God will help me with that one day. And the woman who was head of the meeting said, Ed, I have his address, and I'll give it to you. I've been writing and praying with him for 20 years. Don't tell me there isn't a God. I'm the wrong guy. Don't tell me that isn't the same God for you, or better. Or better. I don't want anybody to believe in the God I believe in. I want you to believe in one you can believe in as much as I do. And if you believe in more, share it with me. Because the other thing I know is God is not done with me yet. I'm just a baby. I always want to be teachable, and I never want to forget that without you and without God, I really am nothing. Thank you.